We'll get moving with the subcommittee this afternoon. I want to again thank everybody for being here. This is, I believe, at least our fourth meeting. We are planning on having, we added one additional meeting, I think we talked about that last time, on May the 14th. The General Assembly comes in on the 16th. The Legislative Oversight Committee meets on the 15th. We meet on the 14th. So hopefully we will come out of the meeting on the 14th with a set of recommendations to go to the Legislative Oversight Committee, and then for their action, and hopefully to be introduced in the General Assembly for its action and consideration. We do need to approve the minutes for March the 12th, and I think those should be in your package. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
We have a motion on the floor, and I don't think it needs a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Like sign if you don't agree. Minutes are approved. As always, make sure to get your any reimbursement forms that you've got to Miss Rennie Hobby before you leave, so she can take care of those matters for you. We have, of course, have been this entire time working on those changes that we deem are most appropriate to moving the LME MCO transition forward for the short session. Those things that absolutely have to get done to help facilitate this process over the that's already underway, as you know, and that hopefully will be at least a successful transition conclusion by the beginning of 2014, which is coming up on us pretty quick. We have run through a number of things. What we have for you this this afternoon, and I don't think it's been passed out yet. We'd have the Sergeant-at-Arms pass out. We have draft legislation, and this is a draft, so you can take it. What I want you to do is take a look at it. Any comments that you may have on it, we may have some time at the end of our meeting today to talk about it a little bit. This is all the stuff that we've dealt with thus far. But I do want you to be sending in, you know, comments, and as has happened in between all of our meetings, to Dr. Porter and myself to take a look at. And this does not include any of the things that we're going to try to go through today, which we have a sort of an ambitious list of barriers on there today that we want to try to go through and see what we have some consensus on, and see where maybe we don't have consensus, or maybe may need to take some additional time to review. Make sure that legislation gets passed out. Okay. Now, in your package, you should have, let me see here. I'm going to do this because I neglected to do it. We are assisted today by our sergeants at arms from the House, Reggie Seals, Martha Gaddison, and Doug Harris. And from the Senate, Sergeant at Arms, Leslie Wright and John Fichette. So we appreciate their assistance with us today. You should have in your packet a couple-page item there. It says potential barriers. These are grouped into several sections, powers, personnel, property, business reporting requirements, and I think the very last one is one on guardianship. What I'd like to do is to kind of go through these. These are things that are actually a compilation of a number of concerns barriers that have been identified by different folks that we may or may not be able to get some agreement on, or decide that they may be beyond the scope of what we can do for the short session, which is going to be, as you all know, a very short session, so we're going to need to be very focused in what we do. Under the sections that say recommendation, these recommendations have come just from a lot of different folks. This is not necessarily an absolute, okay, here's the recommendation, this is what you need to do, but these are comments that have been made that were compiled by Dr. Porter and Mr. Parker from a number of different sources as we've been moving through the process. And what I'd like to do is to, we'll just launch in to the first one here and get some comments, and we'll see how many of these and how quickly we can work through these. I think some of these are going to be fairly straightforward, that there'll be a lot of agreement on. Others may not be the case. Okay, first one under powers of the LME/MCO. And this is really for the MCOs, just to be clear about that. What it says is the current authority provided to the MCO may not allow flexibility needed to take on new business lines or adjust to changes in healthcare funding. And the question here is, in terms of the LME MCO's need and the power to manage and invest funds, to borrow funds, to create appropriate operating entities, and to enter into necessary contracts to do so. Currently, they do not have this authority under 122C. And it seems to me that I think there's been a lot of talk about making sure that the MCOs have the authority to be able to do that under the direction of their governing boards. I don't want to get some comments or takes on that, and maybe some of the LME folks may want to comment on what the need is there. Ms. Shipman.
Thank you. What I know in terms of thinking ahead, because, you know, the changes that are coming down with the healthcare regulations, whether the bill passes or the state or the Supreme Court approves it or not, there are a lot of changes going on in terms of funding for health services. And, you know, I think it's really hard to predict what we might want to do in the future. But, you know, as far as being committed to serving people who need services through the public system, through public funds, whatever those funds are, there are a lot of new resources coming down, you know, not necessarily through SAMHSA, but through other venues that may have different requirements for funding health care. And many of the people that we currently serve, you know, are not well served. And there are lots of potential partnerships in the future, changes. And I think that without this flexibility, it leaves the LMEs as sort of a single line business. And I'm not sure that long term that's necessarily going to work. And there may not be time to come back and change the law as opportunities arise, because they're going to start coming fast.
Okay. Other comments? Mr. Simmons.
Yes, thank you. I'm just curious about what is meant by to create other operating entities. This doesn't step out of the side that MCOs will not be becoming private providers. Is that correct? So what type of operating entities are we talking about?
Well, I can certainly say they would not be becoming private providers. We wouldn't put that in the statute. I don't think we'd put that in the statute or contemplate that. But that is a good point for clarification. And Ms. Copeland, I don't know if you have a comment on that, or Ms. Shipman might have a comment on that.
I don't know of anything specific. I don't have anything specific in mind, but I can say you may need to form a 501c3 or another arm to carry a line, a business line that you're interested in pursuing. So certainly MCOs are prohibited from entering the service provision business, so that would not occur. I can, you know, assure you that that will not occur. It would have nothing to do with service delivery.
Yes, Ms. Simmons.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Just also want to be careful. We recognize the challenge that the spinoffs cause for private providers in the community to provide mental health services, and would like to understand if that fit in that context of appropriate operating entities, or do we expect not to see that happen on a go-forward basis?
I would not expect, right. I think we have the same expectation that you have. And probably I recognize Ms. Shipman, and I'll make a comment. Ms. Shipman.
Yeah, I certainly haven't heard that discussed anywhere. I think it's, you know, in law, along the lines of what kind of requirements might come along with grants for funding services for indigent care or other models under the health reform, under the insurance exchanges, and whether, you know, not as a provider, but as a system manager, funding manager, what are those requirements going to be, and do they fit in with the role that we have now as MCOs under 122C, and whether you may need more focused smaller entities. I mean, it's kind of hard to say exactly what it means. It certainly doesn't mean being a provider or setting up provider agencies. Really, it's the thinking that I've heard is more around managing resources for the benefit of a local community and what kinds of requirements and system vehicles might be needed to do that.
Ms. Coker.
Even during the mental health reform and some of the earlier state plans and statutes, LMEs always had a role to do the best they could to maximize community resources, create partnerships, even to cover non-target population responses and care. And I guess I'm not sure why we would need to add language about new business lines. I mean, especially if you're talking about just looking at creative new ways to fund things that may come down from healthcare reform grants or what have you. I think that a managed care organization already, that it's kind of inherent in its overall role, and it would concern me if we added something that protects the creation of new business lines, because that looks like it could be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
Well, let me, if I might impose on you, Mr. Jordan, does the division have a comment or thought on this particular issue or not?
Thank you, Representative Dollar. Mr. Simmons was asking the question, I was sitting here kind of racking my brain as to what sort of entities and operating entities there would be, and I think Pam Shipman has and Ms. Copeland have kind of gone through and listed those things, but no, I don't know of any other arrangements currently that would be, but I think Pam is very correct. If the Supreme Court decides in favor of continuing, there is a lot of movement real quickly in getting the insurance exchanges and dealing with the new populations that are coming in that would put a lot of pressure on these LME MCOs.
Well, let me ask you a quick question. If we were to pursue some statutory language along this line, do you think we could relatively easily make sure that it was narrow and very specific in terms of what that latitude would be?
I would think so.
Well, let's do this. Since there's some question about this in terms of the scope of it, we can direct the staff to work with the department to see if they can draft some specific language, and then see if we can't get that emailed before the next meeting, get that emailed out to everybody on the committee to take a look at that to see if we're providing flexibility that might be needed and necessary, but not flexibility into an area that would otherwise cause some concern or be open-ended, I guess, in a way that we do not intend. So we'll do that. with item number one. Item number two deals with, and I know this question was raised from quite a lot of folks about the liability of officers, both board members and directors, and officers of the LME MCO. I think I want to get Mr. Parker to comment on this one. I think there have been our staff has done some research on this, and the best we can come up with thus far is we think that all the, as it says there, the current statutes provide all the protections necessary for the board and the LME MCO director. But Mr. Parker, if you could comment on that.
As far as being a new barrier, as in what the subcommittee was requested to draft, there may still be question as whether a public official or governmental immunity would apply, but as what's current with the local management entities or with the area authorities, and so long as these maintain to be area authorities, then the provisions in 122C should still apply. In 122C, 152, there is a waiver of governmental immunity when an area authority purchases liability insurance, but it is just to that amount of insurance that is purchased or available. That, again, whether it's operating as an LME as we recognize now or having a different management function, it is still an area authority, so therefore the limited liability that's provided in statute will still apply. The second question comes to whether as a operating as an MCO, would it maintain a governmental function or would it be a proprietal function? And then I guess on our initial assessment that that the performance, the work that an MCO will do is still within a discretionary governmental role. It's for the benefit of all. I don't foresee where another individual or a proprietal group would be doing the exact same work that an MCO does. So therefore, I believe the current statutes provide the same amount of immunity. That what's available now will still be available even for an LME operating as an MCO.
Because it'll still be covered under 120, under every other statute under 122. Okay. Are there, Ms. Troutman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify then, what we're saying is that they would still be acting as agents of the state, because I think that was an issue that came up in a lawsuit, and so just wanted to confirm that as well.
Mr. Parker, I think the answer is yes, but Mr. Parker, he's shaking his head in the affirmative, yes. Other comment, Ms. Shipp?
Just to say, we always argue sovereign immunity when we go to court, but we never get it. So, just, you know, I don't know, you know, what that means, except that we usually don't ever get granted sovereign immunity. So,
don't do things that get you taken to court.
I keep telling people that.
I'm just picking. For the official minutes, I'm just picking. I'm just picking. Mr. Botts.
I think that back to the previous question, I think the phrase agent of the state is something separate from that's a separate term, separate issue, separate analysis from the governmental immunity that Sean was talking about. So I don't think what Sean was talking about, the two issues for that I saw in number two were for tort liability. So sovereign immunity is not going to protect you from every kind of liability, but for tort liability, if we're talking about officers, then I think the question is whether or not public official immunity applies. And it seems like it would apply, given 122C-152. And I just say seems like, because I'm not an expert on liability issues. I know Sean and I exchanged a few emails, and then Sean Parker exchanged some emails with someone else at the School of Government. So in terms of officers, I think the question is, will they have public official immunity like they currently do? And I don't see any reason why they wouldn't, to the extent that that doctrine applies in any given circumstance. And then the second one is the agency liability. And Sean, you can correct me if I'm, or try to, or jump in and modify if I'm saying anything wrong. But the issue between governmental versus proprietary functions, that goes to whether the agency is liable, as I understand it. And so the question is, now that LMEs are not only performing LME functions, but are also doing things called managed care functions, might a court characterize any of those things as proprietary in nature, thereby the LME losing some governmental immunity for claims brought resulting from those proprietary functions? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but Sean says, I'll just let Sean's answer stand for the response to that question. But agent of the state is, there's some people here from the Attorney General's office, they may be able to talk more coherently about this than me, but agent of the state, that has to do with whether you're acting on behalf of state government, which is a totally separate issue from the two issues, public official immunity for officers and governmental immunity if you're performing proprietary or non-proprietary functions. That's how I understand it. I don't know if...
Do we have somebody here from the AG's office that would want to comment on that or not?
Well, and
if you would identify yourself for the record. And
hey, I'm Rich Slipscomb with the AG's office, and I agree with what Mark was just saying. Agents of the state is really a completely different issue that it does arise in many of the lawsuits, but I don't think it has anything to do with what Mr. Parker was talking about.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Carruth.
Yeah, just throw on the other hat here for a second, but in actually, the county risk management pools has in its liability policy a provision for public officials' liability. So I would think that even if you weren't covered in immunity, if you're acting within the scope, basically the confines of the law in your official capacity, it's going to be a covered peril if you have something that's brought up, some issue that comes up against a board member, which I would think would be something that would be the protection that everybody would be seeking and board members would be seeking. And so, you know, that law does protect them now. So I would think it would not be a problem. And most, you know, of course, there's a public entity pool, but I feel sure probably private carriers as well. I have the same provision in their private liability policies for public officials to cover them in their actions they take.
Thank you. Mr. Parker, did you want to add anything else to that? Okay.
Thanks for the clarification. I agree with that.
All right. Well, let's move on from number two then. I don't think we're going to need to take any action on that at this time. The number three, dealing with... borrowing requirements, restrictions, large healthcare organizations. I think that this was originally brought up in part to talk about the potential future of an MCO and whether or not an MCO could at some point in time, in essence, move out from 122C and move into another set of the statutes and operate more like, for example, a hospital authority or some other authority of that nature. My personal view is that for right now, that's probably a bridge too far until we get the state fully transitioned into the MCOs, that those MCOs are up and running, and that we've got all the bugs worked out, so to speak, that we know we're operating with what we're operating with, then we can come back, I think, as a General Assembly and take a look at if there are other organizational structures that the MCOs could make use of that would facilitate their operations. But my feeling is that that might be taking on far more than what we would be able to fully contemplate in the short session. But I wanted, but we had that on there that was brought forward, and I want to entertain any comments or observations, Dr. Gray.
Thank you, Representative Donnelly. This is Craig and Gray. The number three indicates that the LME has no capacity to incur debt or business expense. The question I raise is, who underwrites any bankruptcy or loss? And would the LME, in that sense, since they are, since any loss that they have in terms of loss from providing medical over psychiatric oversight and guidance and behavioral health, would the LME have the authority to encumber the state in that regard?
I think the answer to that is yes, frankly. That's been my take on it, and I'm be happy to be corrected on that if there's a different understanding. I don't see anyone wanting to raise their hand and talk about that. I think that's the case. I do. Would you, you're smiling. So
I guess means my, happy.
No, these days in this job, a smile does not imply satisfaction.
Duly noted. Duly noted. Ms. Coker.
I'm still a little bit confused by something that came up earlier, but in the last, well, all three of these points so far, is it an either-or that MCOs are either proprietary or they are agents of the state or something? Or is it... What it seems like is we are just totally endorsing that they are proprietary organizations, and somehow, you know, I know I made a comment in an email to two or three of you folks about this. I'm just real concerned if we're granting a whole lot of proprietary rights to something that has arisen from the public side that needs really tight oversight and tight data collection around really specific information. It just seems like this is getting kind of big and amoebic. And I know that from the emails I get that taxpayers are really, really concerned about all this. And I'm just trying to get clarification. Who is ultimately accountable for either the success or the not-so-successful management behaviors of an LME? Does the state take responsibility, because it is the state that is selecting and contracting with these agencies using public dollars? Or is it the LMEs themselves, because they are proprietary and therefore not a whole lot different from a privately run organization? I mean, we've already granted permission for PBH to hold some of its information as proprietary, and a lot of advocates still haven't gotten over that. And I'm just trying to get clarity about where we really are. You know, who is ultimately responsible for the MCOs? The state or each MCO?
Well, the way I would answer that question, I'm going to recognize Mr. Parker to correct me when I'm finished, but it is the state. I mean, ultimately, it does come back to the state. It's our obligation at the state level to ensure that the LME MCOs, that the MCOs are operating correctly within the appropriate parameters, to ensure that the MCOs are being successful. I know that issue has been raised. What happens if an MCO is not successful, if there, you know, if problems arise and they cannot function appropriately, then what would happen? Well, clearly what would happen is the state would step in. And ultimately the state has taken on the liability in this waiver environment. Now, you know, obviously what we want to see, in just in very broad terms, is our very successful MCOs with flexibility to provide the quality of services and to address the mental health needs across a very broad spectrum to the folks who are in their service areas, and to make sure that we are efficiently and effectively, they make sure that the dollars are efficiently and effectively being used for that purpose. They should be, in a sense, freed up to be effective operations, managed care organizations. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the state is going to be on the hook, as it were, it seems to me, if there are fundamental problems. But Mr. Parker may want to illuminate on that a little bit better than I have.
I think with many of the issues you're facing here, that's the resounding question. And the way I have interpreted it thus far is that a LME is still an area authority, which is a local political subdivision of the state. You've not created a new entity in statute or in session law that says, so everything that would apply currently to an area authority is going to continue to apply to these LMEs in this operation beyond what would be further restricted by contract with DMA and the Department and the Division of Mental Health with what they contract to do. So in that sense, I guess whether they're proprietal or not or what activities they will partake in, I'm still viewing it as a area authority is what we have and what is governed in 122C, and all new functions that they may partake will be based on contract with the department, and so all of that would still flow in that authority. But perhaps someone with the department would like to speak again on some of the controls and measures that they have in place or responsibilities.
And I think just to comment a little bit further on that, I think there has been some mention from different quarters discussion about creating MCOs that are more, allowing them to be more independent. But I think that at this stage, that's I don't think that's something that would be coming out of our subcommittee here, or certainly not coming out of the General Assembly in the short session. To me, that's a sort of a longer term issue that can certainly be looked at and studied in terms of the merits and in terms of what the concerns would be and how that would actually operate. I hope I'm being somewhat clear about that. Did you want to comment on it, Mr. Jordan?
Yeah, I think contractually, if the entity fails financially, the responsibility from the Division of Mental Health and DMA under 122C is to make sure that services to the constituents remains. It is my understanding that it would not be our responsibility to cover any debt incurred by the LME MCO in that process.
And what we will do is we will we'll get some of the folks together between now and the next meeting, and we'll see if we can't make sure we have an answer that is universally understood on that point.
And I think too, to be sure, you consider the role of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid in all this, because you can get a real expansionist managed care organization that may know how to expand and grow some things, but when it comes to actually serving the right people, the right services at the right time, so we're minimizing hospitalizations and crisis needs and all that, they may be kind of floundering there. And if we find that CMS becomes unhappy with performance while we're looking at other things, it could bite us in the rear. I really think a waiver can be such a wonderful, an excellent thing given what our state's been through, but it's amazing how the edges of this little operate, the circle of what I thought it was, it just kind of gets more and more confusing. the question about borrowing from counties, was that also included in number one, or do we still have that as a separate question like it was? I saw that we addressed about borrowing in number one, but that wasn't talking about borrowing from the counties yet, was it?
Well, what we are...
We will talk about that, right, at some point.
Yeah, I think we talk about that later.
Okay,
good. That's in there a little further. But what we'll
Thank
do
you.
In terms of item number three is we'll move on from there, and we'll. I think there were a couple of questions raised and about some of the issues surrounding those areas. We'll see if we can get some clarifications on those and get that out to the members. Turning on over to the back of the page, back of that first page, under the item personnel, this is one that's been that I've had great deal. I'll just be very candid with you. As a former personnel director in state government, I always got lots of trepidation about how much latitude would be granted on certain personnel decisions. We've seen in the past up in the Northeast was probably the most egregious scenario up there with Albemarle, not to pick on anybody, but you know, the salary that was being paid was obscene. I mean, just, I could use other words, but not in this setting. And we do not, while I think it's very true, and we suffer with this in state government, we have a number of types of positions in state government that we have a tremendously difficult time recruiting for or retaining. I'll just give you an example. Auditors. State auditor's office hires auditors. They work with them to get their CPA, and then when they get their CPA, a firm comes in and, you know, says, okay, we're going to pay you $15,000 more, and they're gone. And so the agency is back trying to recruit a new auditor. So that happens quite a bit, and it's those challenges are out there. Obviously, in the case of the MCO, there's quite a bit of expertise that is being sought in a number of areas, from IT to financial and others. So the question is, how do you expand the ability to for the MCO to address those, the ability to attract and retain the types of skilled staff, but still keeping that within those salaries from having a scenario like we had up in the Northeast, or with the ABC Commission, and I could name some other examples over the years. The recommendation there, I think, in my mind, that verbiage, that's not statutory verbiage, but statutory verbiage that would follow along that line, where we would give the MCOs the ability to hire beyond the normal range in terms of compensation. If they can demonstrate in writing that is necessary to get and to retain, to attract and retain that that type of that particular position, and have that before any salary would be approved above the normal hiring range, that it would have to go through the Secretary of Health and Human Services to make sure that there's a check on, you know, a fully independent check on that particular salary request. So with that said, any comments on that, or Dr. Gray?
It's just very interesting, Representative Dollar, as we expand the footprint of state-run health programs. By 2014, we will have, including the state health plan, Medicaid, and its expanded role, we'll have over 25% of the population having receiving benefits under a state-run program. It's also very interesting to note that the state seems to attach more importance to the running of a multi-million dollar state lottery than it does to a multi-billion dollar health benefit program.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that comment. You know, one of the things that had to be done with the state lottery, mentioning the state lottery, as you know, what they did over the state lottery is they took the flexibility that they had with regard to salaries, and they started boosting up a bunch of salaries over there when everybody else was having to cut back or to have to keep things flat. And so a provision was put into the budget in is either 2009 or 2010. I think it was 2009. There was a provision put in the state budget to stop the state lottery from being able to grant any salary increases over and above what was otherwise to be granted to regular state employees. So again, you know, that's another one of those areas, as you have pointed out, that we've seen people have flexibility and not use that flexibility in a prudent and appropriate way, but we're certainly using it, to at least to many of our minds, in a very inappropriate way. Ms. Shipman.
Yes. You know, there are a number of provisions that impact LME salary scales, one of which is not paying higher than the highest county. And, you know, one of our challenges being right next door to Mecklenburg County is they aren't under the state personnel system, and they tend to pay higher than we do for just about any position there is. And so, you know, we're continuously competing with them for staff, with providers for staff, with hospitals for staff, and with insurance companies for staff. And so where we need to get people from, you know, are either not in the state personnel system, you know, which Mecklenburg isn't and none of the others are, and I think most of the public authorities in this state are not in the state personnel system. So, you know, these limits didn't prevent, you know, Albemarle LME from paying their director an exorbitant salary. And, you know, if you have a bad actor, you know, all the rules in the world don't seem to stop them, but it does prevent LMEs, and I think state government as well, from really getting the level of staff that they need. You know, forces you to contract if you can't hire, and, you know, there's a lot of workarounds that would really be beneficial, I think, for state government as well as for LMEs if these restrictions weren't so onerous. And, you know, the public system isn't going to make it if we can't get the right staff. So,
Mr. Simmons.
Just an anecdotal comment. I think one mechanism to keep it all fair and honest are compensation studies. And compensation studies take into account the amount of money an executive or a high-level person or someone running IT is managing in the marketplace so that you can adequately recruit and retain the kind of folks we need. I think with this multi-billion-dollar Medicaid business, that it's really critical, I think, as we've learned in the past, to really be able to recruit and retain talent, particularly as you go out into the marketplace and in the MCO kind of arena. So sometimes you get what you pay for. Not that all the folks that work for all of us that don't earn what they should aren't doing an excellent job, but in some of these critical positions, it's pretty competitive for really good folks at the operating IT and the senior management level. So one way we found to be fair and balanced in that is to use compensation studies and sometimes more than one comp study for a particular position to make sure it's fair. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Other comments on that? So if I'm understanding everyone, you're in agreement that there should be additional flexibility for the MCOs to be able to hire who you need to hire from a compensation standpoint. But there's I don't think I'm noting any objection to making sure that that would be done with the appropriate documentation and that oversight from the department is not something anyone would have an objection to. And Mr. Simmons, I hadn't thought in terms of the compensation. Of course, you know, state government does those quite often. But we'll try to do a little bit of work on the thought about compensation study and whether or not we'd want to either direct that to be done or maybe handle that in a different way. You know, our problem, of course, in state government as a whole, you know, we're got, if you add in teachers, so what are we, around 160, 170 some thousand employees, it makes it extremely difficult, you know, to get the salaries the way they probably should be. All right, we'll move on from there. Item number two, I think it was a fairly straightforward item about who appoints the LME MCO governing board, and if I recall correctly, there had been discussions between the counties and the LMEs, and had been some agreement, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the MCO director would be, instead of doing it with a consensus of the counties as it was done in the past, having the governing board of the MCO, having the executive director answer to the governing board, which would make sense to me. I'm seeing heads shaking approvingly, so okay, we're good on that one. All right. The next item down is gets into the area of ownership of real property and intellectual property, and I think this issue has already had some discussion. As it says there, county approval is now required for any LME MCO to hold title to real property. MCOs need the flexibility to, or contention is that MCOs need the flexibility to purchase, invest, and own property necessary for the successful operation of the waiver and to best benefit all participating counties. So the question is whether we add language in to the statute to clarify that MCOs can purchase and hold title and improve and finance real property with the appropriate approval of the governing board and the local government commission and the oversight of Health and Human Services, because obviously we don't want, you know, we're not interested in MCOs becoming, you know, office speculators or, you know, that sort of thing. It obviously has to be tied directly to the purposes for which the organization is out there, for the people with disabilities and mental illnesses and the like. I want to get some comments from folks on that. We had had, I'll mention one other thing. I think we'd had some conversations back and forth, some preliminary conversations with the local government commission, and I think we've got to have some more conversation with them about getting them to understand what we're talking about there and how the local government commission may or may not help participate in using their expertise in this area. But comments from the committee. Ms. Shipman.
Okay, I hate to be first every time. But what we're finding, you know, is that as the system needs to be developed, as we make investments, right now providers do not have the capital, and the business environment has been so unstable that it's been, you know, difficult for providers to make investments in, you know, buildings. We just spent $2.5 million on a crisis center in one of our counties. And our concern is if that county changed their mind and decided to go with a different group, you know, that we would lose that $2.5 million investment and wouldn't have those resources to build that center somewhere else in another county that would be within our jurisdiction. And so there are lots of examples where, you know, system investments are more and more, at least in our area, being made by us, you know, and we just want not to lose those if, you know, a county withdraws from our LME at some future point. So that's our concern around owning property.
And that's that's sort of covered in the next item about the ownership of property. And it would seem to me that the MCO would own the property, as opposed to in the past it might be the county, but the MCO would be funding it. I mean, something that the county currently owns, a county would own. But and if a county withdrew, let's say in the case of what you're talking about, if a county were to withdraw at some point in time, if the MCO built the facility, let's say it was a treatment facility, then, you know, they may want to negotiate. The county may want to negotiate with the MCO to purchase that. They may not. But the MCO would have the property. And if the MCO itself, in a different scenario, were to, I don't want to say go under. That's not quite what I'm trying to say. But anyway, if they were to no longer to be, then their successor organization would pick up the property or it would revert to the state and be the state's property. With the MCO, though, you know, controlling the building of the property and the financing it in that regard.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. As it stands now, we would lose that property, though.
Mr. Carruth.
Yeah, but, you know, by the fact that the new corporate office of PBH is in Cabarrus County, we would love to pull out and get us a brand-new office building for the county employees. But I joke with Kevin and Pam about that a lot. But yeah, I agree that I think that that's got to be the case because, like, and I, you know, I guess in a lot of ways our county holds a tremendous amount of power over PBH because if we were to pull out of PBH, suddenly, you know, you've got to reconstruct everything because that's where the headquarters is at. And there's got to be some way that you, at least I would think at the level of the LME, main LME offices. Now, when you get into the individual counties, you know, there might be something there that if there's opposition, maybe some compromise there. But I think at the corporate level anyway, that's got to stay and be revert back to the state or whoever the successor organization is if that LME is dissolved because you're just going to get into a big mess. If not.
Other comments on that?
Also, one additional thing is that I know that back when we were in the process, PBH has been in the process of building their new area headquarters there in Cabarrus. It is almost, for our Board of Commissioners, it was almost like did not really understand why in the world they were even coming, you know, to the Board of Commissioners to get approval to build the building because, okay, you're building a building, you know, and why would that, if it was not, you're bringing it for a board that really didn't understand the need, you know, fortunately the board pretty well accepted, yeah, this is just a rubber stamp, but, you know, it could be very easy where any one county could hold hostage the entire LME because for this very issue. So.
Other comments on items 1 and 2 on there? Well, if not, I think there seems to be some fairly good agreement on those two items, so we will see what the statutory language would look like. Turning over to page 3, it says item number 3, under the area of currently there are no exemptions for LME MCOs to public records laws, as there are for hospitals and universities and other agencies. This has been brought forward as a barrier for the MCOs. So I'm not going to have any further comment on that right now. I'm going to let the committee speak to this as to what concerns people may or may not have with compliance with the MCO compliance with current public records laws and the issue of transparency.
Ms. Weaver.
I'd like to ask Mark Botts if he could explain this a little better. In other words, what are the hospitals and the universities exempt from in regards to public records?
Mr. Botts.
I'm not familiar with the statutes that provide exemptions to hospitals and universities, so, you know, that's not something I've looked at. It's a good question, and that's a question to look at if we're talking about giving exemptions similar to those agencies. Then obviously we need to know what those exemptions are. And I think that the task here in any of these provisions, at least when it comes to drafting legislation, is to really identify what the limit is, what the problem is. You know, if going back to number one, the power to manage, invest funds, borrow money, create operating entities, I mean, there may be need to be changes, but then that really is, you know, how is LME currently hindered? How is it unduly restrained? If we can identify that, both with the question with respect to number one and this public records issue, if someone can articulate that, then it's easier to develop a remedy. So.
And also...
Well, Ms. Weaver, what I thought I might do is ask Mr. Parker if he wanted to make any comments on that or not. No, he's passing on that. Ms. Weaver.
And the other question I have is, if this is a public system, then how can you take a public entity and system and make it exempt from public records laws?
Ms. Coker.
The last phrase in number three, in bold, about LME's need to protect competitive health care information. What is the competitive? I think what's still not clear to me, and I've written, Pam, at times I'm satisfied with what I get told, but in the bigger scheme of thinking about a public system, I'm still not sure. Who are we competing against? What's the competition here? And how impeding is it that everything be open as it is? Kind of like to get to Mark's question.
Well, I think where part of this has come up, it's my understanding, and then Ms. Shipman can correct me, but part of it is that PBH developed over the course of their 6-7 years some systems for doing what they do, some business systems, from some payment systems and the like, if I'm understanding it correctly. And so there's obligation, as I recall, in the statute in 916 for PBH to share those with the other transitioning LME MCOs so that they could benefit from, you know, all that was invested in developing that. But one of the questions that came up was, well, in sharing that with the other LME MCOs, the desire was not to, you know, was to make sure that that did not get shared beyond that with the you know, with some competitive private company. In other words, that they wouldn't get the information, the process from PBH, and an LME MCO wouldn't get that and then turn around and say, well, gee, you know, we could market this, we could sell this to somebody and make a profit on it. So there was that narrow concern, which I think has been addressed in some agreements among the LME MCOs and the people that are transitioning. That's at least my understanding, and if it's not correct, then the department can correct me on it. Obviously, there are things that are not public. I mean, you know, health records are not public, and there's a whole range of things that would obviously not be public. They wouldn't be public now, and they're not public now, and when you wouldn't want public. Beyond that, Ms. Shipman,
Yeah, I think it's you're really talking probably about a pretty narrow range of competitive healthcare information. You know, should the day come when we're bidding with private companies for managed care business in this state right now, all the board meetings, discussions about bids and all that are public record. So this is a protection hospitals have in 130, their legislation 131, that type of information is not subject to public records laws. If we get proposals from providers, they're often surprised to know that, oh, no, it's public record if somebody knows you sent this and they want a copy of it, you know. Depending on whether it's a service provider or an IT provider or whatever, you know, providers, that's their, you know, livelihood, what they send you as their proposal. So, you know, we've run into that before. On the issue about the documents that we had when we went, that we were using in our system, you know, we couldn't get our hands on anything like this when we went live in 2005. So what our concern was, we had some private consultants come to us and suggest that, you know, we let them have those documents and they would sell them to LMEs and we would get royalties off of that because they already had some consulting contracts and, you know, this would be good for everybody. And we kind of felt like, you know, this is not what we want to do. And so we did, because I think the day will come when we may be competing with commercial companies for business in the state. The idea was to give this to the LMEs that were going live, which we did, but to sort of keep it among them for now and for them to not allow their consultants to take it and use it in their private business with, you know, whatever other entities may be competing with us in the future. So it was our effort around that was an attempt trying to keep that information not be exploited and used to make money for people. You know, sometimes no good deed gets unpunished, and, you know, this really got misunderstood all the way around. However, the idea was just to keep the information for the LMEs for now, not let consultants make money off of it. Like I said, it's been widely misconstrued, but, you know, and that's what, you know, that's one thing that's happened in the past. But going forward, there's a narrow range of information that may need to be kept confidential. And as far as business lines, competitions, bids you might make, information you might receive from entities that are bidding to you as a payer, that is not protected. So I think those are business concerns. It's just basically business concerns. And I do think also the thing that's not understood well is there's a difference between copywriting something and, you know, you can copyright something. That doesn't mean it's not available as a public record just because it's copyrighted. So I think that was a point of confusion with that as well.
Mr. Botts.
Yeah. So in answering an earlier question from Ms. Weaver, I haven't looked at the exemption that hospitals have, other than I have noted that they do have an exemption from the public records for things called competitive healthcare information. So that's something that certainly seems worth looking at, you know, to see, you know, of taking a similar exemption and applying it to LMEs, MCOs. And we can look at court, you know, there are probably some court cases on defining that term and maybe applying that term. There's already an exemption in the public records law for trade secrets, which applies to some of the information that a private entity might give to an LME or a governmental entity. You know, maybe the scope of that exemption is not broad enough to protect private information. I don't know, but there's currently an exemption for information that a governmental entity receives from a private entity under the trade secrets exemption. And I think that you know, without getting into all the controversy that surrounded the non-disclosure agreement, because it's not like I haven't said something about that before, but I think that the problem, I think the reason we're looking at the public records law and the need for an exemption where one did not exist is because there were questions about that non-disclosure agreement, because you can't create an exemption to public records by writing a non-disclosure agreement and having someone sign it. But the reason that non-disclosure agreement was used was for the reasons that have been described here, that there's a lot of work and time, resources invested in creating systems that were for PBH. The state wanted it shared with other LMEs because everyone has to gear up quickly. Why reinvent the wheel? And there was also, it was demonstrated that PBH had created some tools that were effective, so it was reasonable to share those. But PBH also had a legitimate concern about, you know, private entities getting a hold of this information and using it for themselves for commercial purposes, for financial gain. So I think the parameters or scope of an exemption is something to be worked out, but I think there's clearly a need to look at that.
Ms. Coker.
Ms. Coker keeps her hand on the button.
You know I do.
But thank you for sharing it. I just want to say that the council has struggled with this issue. You know, MCOs have struggled with this issue. But one thing that we are clear about, we are public entities. We know that there's an appropriate application for the public records law. And there's also appropriate application in our minds for exemptions, as Pam outlined. And we don't want to discourage innovation. And more importantly, we don't want to discourage statewide adoption or system-wide adoption of that innovation that's going to help move us forward and move us forward in a timely fashion. So the idea of narrow scope or narrowly defined exceptions, we support wholeheartedly and hope that we can come to that.
Well, let me go ahead and then I'll comment. Ms. Coker.
Well, overall, this issue maybe hasn't meant so much to me, but the people that keep arguing and are concerned about it, I think it all comes down to our sense as taxpayers and as consumers or family members that the sovereignty issue, again, that this information, you know, we're very proud of all the work PBH has done, and we know they've come up with some really effective tools. But I guess we consider this something that gets done in service to the public, and that there's not so much regard for how much eventual profit or growth. Maybe profit's the wrong word, but I'm going to sound naive here, but so what if eventually they are competing against private organizations that may have been influenced by something they learned from their document? I mean, I think that's what seems weird to the thinking of a lot of citizens, is that it's a public organization. Our funds have paid for this, and yet they're hiding they feel like it's important to kind of hide these resources from other people. And that's where red flags go up for a lot of people. Is that to us, it's public. And, you know, even if public entities compete with private ones, we would assume the best quality organization is going to get the contract in spite of what tools influenced what. But I'm just trying to say there, I can see the merit to this argument because it has such a... you start looking through a lens of proprietary efforts instead of public efforts meant for the public good paid by public dollars.
Ms. Weaver.
I do agree with Ms. Shipman that this whole thing about the non-disclosure agreement and proprietary and public records is very confusing. And I'm sure it's no secret that my LME board are the ones that had the biggest problem with this. But it gets personal for me because as a CFAC member to that LME board, I was required to sign an agreement with the LME that I would abide with that non-disclosure agreement. And that's where I think it's starting to get a little bit out there. And I think it warrants some guidelines.
Ms. Shipman.
We didn't require our own CFAC to sign non-disclosure agreements. So I'm not sure can't comment on that. But this is not secret information. If somebody asks for this information tomorrow, they can have it. But it is copyrighted. Part of the purpose of the agreement was that we gave the LMEs permission to change it, put their name in it. We gave it to them in Word format so they could do anything they needed to do with it to gear up quickly. And so the purpose of the agreement is you're getting this unprotected document. It's copyrighted. We don't want your consultants are the ones that were supposed to be covered under the agreement. We don't want your consultants taking this unprotected document, go out there, you know, using it in other parts of their business and charging $1,000 for it or whatever. So, you know, the agreement, the non-disclosure part applied to the consultants of the MCO, and the rest of the agreement gave the MCO permission to use these copyrighted materials any way they wanted to use it. But they're not secret documents. They're not unavailable for anybody to look at. In fact, there are handbooks and all kinds of things that people have. But we gave the other LMEs unprotected versions of them to the extent that we had those. So that was the whole point. I almost wish we'd never done it. But anyway, you know, because it's just been so misunderstood. And the intent was to help LMEs kind of, you know, give them something to give them a head start, you know, kind of keep it in the public sector for a while just to give people a chance to get up and get going and get a little bit of a head start. But again, it's not private secret information. It's just copyrighted.
Well, my sense is, and we'll take some more comments, people might have them, but you know, my sense is, generally speaking, any proposal in any legislation, at least since I've been here, what my observation is, that deals with public records laws and any restriction thereof tends to be highly controversial and, you know, gets a lot of people stirring around and creates all kinds of problems and headaches that we don't necessarily want associated with a piece of governance legislation that we're trying to move through and get done by the end of the short session. So, at least my view of it is, if anybody has on the committee or you know, wants to draft a very narrow provision that maybe would just address the most important piece of this, then why don't you do that and get it to our staff, and then we can get it distributed out to the committee, and we can see if that, you know, if that will fly with the committee when we get together in May or not. And then we can deal with it that way. Mr. Botts.
I think a way going forward, I think there was ill will created by the non-disclosure agreement. I think the way to get beyond that is to look at why that was used in the first place, even though I think it was ill-conceived. Because I think when you were asked to sign it, Ms. Weaver, you're basically being asked to promise not to follow the public records law of North Carolina, and I think that's inappropriate. The way to get beyond that is say, wow, why were we in that situation? And let's hope they aren't having to use a tool like a non-disclosure agreement. And you won't have to use that. You won't have to use those mechanisms. You won't be asked to do something like that if we create an exemption to the public records law that's narrowly tailored to protect the interests of the LMEs that's appropriate. And so we can all know what's clearly public record and what's not. So I think I can see why it created ill feelings. The way going forward, I think, is to focus, just forget that happened, if we can, and focus on, well, okay, what kind of exemption do we need to draft so that people aren't put in that position again?
Ms. Riddle.
There's one other suggestion that I would make that I think is not quite in the realm of this committee, but it has to do with educating particularly families and consumers about what these copyrighted materials are. I think it's always so much easier to understand the rationales that several of you are offering when you understand what it is that we're talking about. So I would encourage those of you that are charged with consumer education to get a little bit of information out. I think there'll be less of a bugaboo about this. And Mr. Botts, I also agree with your point. I'm very interested to see that narrowly crafted language. Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll move forward along those lines and see what we come back with in May. All right. The next, we got a next set of bullet points. Let's do this. Let's take about a, let's take a 5 minute break. Well, it'll be more than that. Let's start back at 3:30. Let's just take a quick break until 3:30 and we'll reconvene the, subcommittee. Okay, and the committee will come back to order, and we are on we're on page 3, and we're under the bullet point business and reporting requirements. And I think some of this we can somewhat group together. Let me take the first two. It's my understanding, subject to being wrong, that this local business plan isn't, as it says here, is not consistent with the reports and the plans and the like with the waiver, and that that requirement could be eliminated with basically no problem. It's just taking away a report that's not necessarily needed anymore. It's also my understanding that the delivery of a quarterly report to the counties is something that's not necessarily needed anymore. And I think that dovetails into item number 3 there, that the recommendation would be that someone on the director or someone assigned by the director would go annually to the various county commissioners, the various county commissioner boards in the catchment area, and give them a presentation in terms of the service reports and the financials for the LME MCO. And that would be done on an annual basis. So looking at those first three items there, the elimination of the local business plan, the elimination of the quarterly service reports to the counties, and allowing someone other than the director, if I understood it correctly, to be able to make the presentation to the county commissioners, the various boards on an annual basis, that those changes would just help facilitate and clean up the process. Are there any comments on those, any of those three recommendations, Dr. Gray?
Thank you, Representative Dollar. I would be concerned that we eliminate all local business planning that would be consistent with the requirements of the operation. I think these are designed to be independent businesses that provide behavioral health services, and a business plan that is consistent with the operation would be insurance that they would function in a business-like manner. On the second matter, in terms of reporting to the counties, I think that there will be, at least as far as the LME is concerned, or the MCO, will be reporting on a regular basis to the state, either the departments, to the department and to the divisions. It would seem reasonable that those reports should also go to the counties, who are what might be described as an engaged entity. So I wouldn't necessarily create an opportunity to eliminate all reporting to the counties. Indeed, they should be included in the reporting that goes to the state.
Okay. Ms. Kosler.
Okay. Thank you. A couple of things. In terms of the local business plan, it was our thinking that the statewide waiver plan is the local business plan. They are one and the same. We are all implementing the same plan, so that was the rationale behind eliminating the local business plan. In terms of the county reporting, we again agree that it should be annual. We work with the County Commissioners Association on this reporting schedule and have their agreement that that would be sufficient as well. So I just wanted to add that for the committee's information.
Well, let me just ask a question of you, Ms. Copeland. In terms of the reporting that comes to the state, I'm not familiar with all of the reporting that, in terms of the details of that, but would there be a problem in some of that reporting, same email transmissions that are being sent to the states and to the counties?
I'm sure it wouldn't be. I'm not sure that it would be how it would be presented in a fashion that the counties would, that would be valuable for the counties, but it certainly wouldn't be a problem to shoot it out to them. No, not at all.
Ms. Troutman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given following the conversation from the department's waiver advisory committee, they're developing some benchmarks and dashboards to make it very easy to see the performance and progress of the waiver MCOs, LMEs, and I would recommend that those be shared with the counties. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi. Good afternoon. I just want to plug this in the year of the committee, the construction of the LMEs, the local management entities, when you took down the old legislation regarding mental health authority, and I have read this before, and then going further, taking down legislation of LMEs to go in MCO, there are some functions of kind of mental health authority in terms, in regards to the mental health conditions of the citizens of a particular jurisdiction that is now kind of disappearing slowly and leaving only in public health, that to the something called the SACH report that we need to do with mandatory community assessments, you really only leave in public health in the state of North Carolina, like providing you and the citizens some guidance regarding what are the conditions of health and mental health of the citizens. I probably you couldn't do anything with what I'm saying at this point, but as I have spent so much time studying the legislation, history of the legislation in North Carolina, I want to let you know that the whole, when you are taking down mental health authority partially, you're taking down some provisions that look a little more like what public health provisions that have to instruct the citizens of what the conditions are. And then you're having another problem that is probably 75% of the funding, or 80, 90% of the funding is going to be Medicaid funding. The Medicaid legislation is going to overrule in terms of what is the thinking regarding mental health when there are maybe like 60-70% of population equal to the Medicaid that also is in need of mental health services. I just wanted to make that comment for the record.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Jordan.
Thank you. In regards to the business plan, I don't think that the elements in the business plan are out of date with where we're moving. It talks about planning. It talks about network development. It talks about financial management. It talks about how you're going to expend your surplus and the expansion of services. Talks about gaps analysis. It may not belong in statute anymore, but kind of like what Dr. Gray was saying, I do believe that a structured planning process should be in making sure that the needs of the community are being met and that the services are the appropriate services that are being done. I believe that through the reporting that we have, there's almost the ability to almost reverse the process and have, on the information that's coming in from the LME MCOs, for the state to produce a report back to to the LMEs saying this is where you are in your service provision using your own information. What do you plan to do with, you know, the fact that you have no services for adolescent substance abuse? And it may be that that gap is there because there's no need for that service. But I think to force people to look on a go-forward basis is not a bad idea, whether it needs to be statutorial or just in the contract, I think may be the best thing to argue.
Ms. Riddle.
Like to follow up on both my colleagues' comments, agreeing with them both. I do believe that we have some excellent outcomes reporting systems that make extant information that's important for families, consumers, the taxpayer in general. I, as one who has to write a state plan every 5 years, there's a lot of information in my own state plan that is extraneous. But this focus on, I think, outcomes and the focus that you described, Mr. Jordan, I think are very, very appropriate. And I know I would not want to be the person that announced to my constituency that we weren't going to have a local business plan anymore. So I would go for streamlining that, focusing on input and outcome. Thank you.
Mr. Botts.
One statute, GS-122C-115, I believe, is the one that says two or more counties jointly may establish an area authority with approval of the secretary. And it doesn't say what that process is for secretary approval. But there is laid out in the business plan statute a process. And so if I just wanted to make people aware of that if you delete wholesale the business plan statute, you get rid of any statutorily described process for a secretary to approve the creation of a new area authority. So the question is, do you want the secretary to have that authority? And second, does that need to be spelled, that process, does it need to be spelled out in statute as it currently is in the business plan statute? But the bottom line is, if you get rid of the business plan statute, you get rid of that process. And the question is, do you want to say something else somewhere else?
Well, just a question to Mr. Botts real quick. Isn't that taken care of in a sense in the bill that was passed last year?
In House Bill?
I mean, in the waiver itself, in the creation of the waiver itself.
Well, there's in House Bill 916, which you're talking about, that which addresses the process for, I guess that's the last piece of legislation that addresses
right.
The, frankly, there's a disconnect between the waiver process and the legislation that addresses that and statutory law, which addresses LMEs and the creation of LMEs. And those two have not, even in House Bill 916, which addresses both those issues, it hasn't tied those two processes together. And there's actually been some problems that have been arisen from that, which folks have tried to figure out what to do about since then. So I don't think that the uncodified legislation that addresses the waiver process sufficiently addresses the establishment of an area authority.
But let me ask, Mr. Cochran.
Thank you. My concern would be if there's no business plan and no way to influence by stakeholders, we may lose a very big portion of the ability of stakeholders to influence how services are developed. Also, the LME is responsible for more than the waiver. So I don't think you can say the statewide waiver is the business plan when the responsibility, the LME still have a lot of responsibility, particularly around planning for mental health, DD&SA.
Well, let me ask this question, and Ms. Troughton, you may be able to help me with this or someone else, but the quarterly service reports, if there's a dashboard being created or developed, I guess my question is, would that take place of the
with all the pertinent information in a quarterly service report essentially be in there and be available, or not, or is that a totally totally different animal? And if you don't know the answer to that, I might maybe you should address it to Ms. Copeland.
They're in the process of developing it, and again, it's both performance measures with regards to service and financial performance too are the components of the dashboard.
Mr. Jordan.
I know that one of the things that we've had to deal with, even with the using of the PBH information, has been standardization. And I think one of the issues in may be that the counties have the information they want in a certain format, and if we at the state are just sending that to them, we would have a standard format here that may not match what each of the individual counties would want, and that may be one of the issues that we would deal with in presenting a dashboard or whatever. Would have to be that the acceptance that the elements that the counties are looking for can be produced in one single format.
It sounds like to me, if somebody correct me if I'm wrong, that's still sort of coming together. That hasn't been finalized at this point. Okay. Well, let me ask about item number three there then. I'm really not sure how much that was identified as a barrier, but I'm really not sure how much what we're talking about changing there in terms of the actual annual report to the boards of county commissioners. Can you help me with that, Ms. Troutman, or Ms. Copeland, whichever?
It's my understanding that some of the concerns of the LMEs, especially when you have one with 19, is just physically getting around to all of the counties. In this case, it was twice a year. So we had no problems with having a staff person report to the boards of county commissioners at their request, along with the financial and service data.
All we would be doing in this instance under item number three is taking a biannual report and making it an annual report and having someone other than the executive director be able to present that to a board of commissioners. Am I correct about that?
Yes, and again, what we had agreed to with the council was more to allow staff to participate in making that presentation. If there's not a problem preparing a biennial report, I think more information the better, but it's just that physical presence of the director that was problematic based on our conversations.
Ms. Copeland.
One other piece to that is that, yes, the director having to deliver the presentation, and that has changed to that we would distribute the information, and then upon request, the director or staff person could then present the information. So it really removes the requirement to appear in person, you know, unless it is requested by the county.
Okay. So it sounds like of those first three items, the item number three, in terms of, as you just described it, Ms. Copeland, is the one that there's pretty much agreement on, but I don't think we have much in the way of agreement on that. We'll actually have a lot of concerns in terms of the any elimination of the local business plan or the quarterly service reports, if I'm gauging everybody's comments correctly. Okay. All right. Item number four is an accounting item, so maybe we got an accountant among us. In terms of eliminating modified accrual and using full accrual, does somebody from the department or somebody who actually knows about that want to speak to that point? Somebody raised it as a barrier. I mean, I'm assuming it's a barrier, but I'm going to call on you anyway, Mr. Jordan. So I'm just.
I am not an accountant, and I don't play one on TV.
Okay.
I have no idea what this is in reference to. But okay. If you want, I can do some legwork and get back.
Okay. Well, Ms. Chipman, are you familiar with this particular item?
I think I can tell you a little bit about it, whether it'll make sense or not, I don't know. But, you know, and I know Lisa's here. She could probably explain it better than anybody. But, you know, accruals, when you have managed care or when you're paying out lots of money, like, you know, I don't know, $12 million a month and stuff, a lot of that you don't pay, but you want to know that you're going to pay it. So they, you have kind of your accruals, which is what you expect to pay out based on the volume of billing or whatever, or your authorizations. But then because the state's on a cash system, I don't know, Lisa, stand up if you think I'm way off the mark. Where did she go? We reverse them out before we do the report. So I think Lisa could answer this the best.
I think we have someone there. If you just identify yourself, please.
Yes, sir. I'm Lisa Wainwright. I'm the executive director of East Carolina Behavioral Health. Excuse me. The issue here is that GS 159 empowers the local government commission to establish the basis of accounting for local governments, and they have established modified accrual. We as MCOs have to operate under full accrual, so this is just to be sure that the local government commission would not, for whatever reason, ever come back and say, oh, no, you're a local government, you got to do modified accrual, which would put us out of compliance with CMS and DMA. That's the issue.
I see. Was there someone, Mr. Parker, was someone here from the local government commission? No? Okay. I thought there was somebody here earlier, but maybe they're not here. All right. Well, it sounds to me like all we need to do is if the department would just check back, and if we need to make that change to full accrual in order to make sure we don't run into the issue that Ms. Wainwright raised, then, you know, we can adjust the statute accordingly. On the last page on the back, we have two other items. Current statute allows LGC to override the finance officer in the payment of a bill the FO has declined to pay. And there was a recommendation that this language be eliminated. So I guess the question is, why would we be eliminating that language? What would be the purpose of that? And that, Ms. Copeland.
Well, the MCO has to have the authority to manage its funds and have that final authority.
Okay. Just ask the department, is that y'all's understanding as well? Or do you can, well, if you would, if you could go back and just verify that would need to be done, or that needs to be done, or if it needs to be done.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hartzell.
I'd really like to learn a little bit more about that, because I've never seen the LGC entering a matter of this sort without good reason to do that. And that good reason generally inures to the benefit of us all, not particularly including the state of North Carolina, which is backstopping most of this anyway. So I'm not sure. I'm not saying one way or another. And it's a little different entity. But I'd be a little concerned about that, because what it all talks about is the integration of services and service deliveries and payments in some fashion.
Well, we will get to the we'll get an answer on that, Senator Hartzell. We'll get an answer on that. All right. The final issue that we have here is the issue of guardianship. There have been a number of it's been a very active area, and what I would like to do is to get Mr. Jordan, if he could start out our discussion of guardianship and where we currently are and where the state currently is on that issue, because there's been a number of
of issues that have been coming up where the state and others have been working on some resolution.
Whenever we started into the LME MCO world, it became very apparent that there was a conflict of interest around guardianship. Late last fall, we put together a stakeholder group to start working on that with folks from the counties, county DSS, some corporate guardians, and some mental health folks. As we've been looking at it through the department, we've identified that currently there's approximately 1,691 individuals who are receiving services either through LME guardianship or corporate guardianship. What we've been looking at is what would be the proper way to deal with this. One of the things that the Division of Mental Health took upon itself was this was a problem we owned because we're the ones changing our system and we needed to work through the solution. And as we've worked, we've made a proposal to the stakeholder group and then to the DSS directors that guardianship would transfer, that 122C, Section 122 would go away, and that DSS would be responsible for guardianship. In that process, that the state Division of Mental Health would transfer out of our social service block grant funds the money appropriate to deal with those 1,691 folks so that the Division of Social Services could send the money down to the counties so that they could take over as guardians. One of the issues that we're trying to address right now is from a mental health contracting standpoint, from a contract guardian, they would have one contract with five counties in an LME. Now that contract has to be divided five ways, so it becomes a little bit more cumbersome to manage, and those are the things we're trying to iron out right now as we seek resolution on the handoff to the folks at DSS.
Well, just to clarify from my understanding, and you may have said it and it just went by me, would the DSS in that instance be able to contract out then for guardianship services?
It is my understanding that they would.
They would. Okay. Yes, sir.
This issue is a little more complex, and the Association of Social Service Directors is trying to sponsor a bill that will kind of clarify some items, and some people don't know I manage a combined department in which we have the LME and we have also public health and social services. In Wake, we have placed the guardianship under social services since 5 years ago, so people are trained and understand that right now the way it's done, a guardian performs some combined functions. I think we're doing like integrated services when normally people need five levels of services. Guardianship is a legal representation. It's like you have a parent, a substitute parent that is going to represent you legally and is going to advocate for you, and this is all what guardianship means as I understand the law. But probably Sam and Mark will shed more light. At the same time, that individual who's mentally ill is going, like, let's say, to therapy, has a clinical home, and sometimes they get enhanced services, and in some places, they need placement. So the LME also performs the care coordination function for that particular individual. If I'm the guardian right now and I'm the LME director under my jurisdiction, I have control over those five things, which facilitates the process. Once it gets split, the social services get the contract for guardianship that only requires the legal representation. They very scared that people don't understand what guardianship means, and they're thinking that it means case management also and placement authority, which is really, I don't believe it does. So I think that issue probably have to be investigated a little more, and probably add some languages that speak about the need for very close coordination then between those two public entities, the MCO and the Department of Social Services.
Mr. Cochran.
Thank you, sir. There's been a lot of issues over time about DSS and mental health coordination, and I agree with the recent comments. But it seems like that the task force needs to come forward with some recommendations to really address some of that. And some of the issues have been actually over-restriction of people's rights. So there is concern, I think, that we be careful about how that gets transferred and the fund support guardianship. Just a comment on that. Thank you.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Working in the clerk's office, we handle many of these with incompetence proceedings. And, of course, there are different guardianships, the general, the person, and the estate. And would this just be for the Medicaid people? And also, I did talk to the person with a DSS in Randolph County, and she said they would definitely have to hire a new person to help with this.
Mr. Jordan.
As we've been looking at this, it would represent both levels of guardianship that the individual would be under the way it was currently in 122C. Ramon is correct. There are some issues around the coordination. There are some concerns on the part of the DSS directors that the lack of connection between them and the MCO may create a burden upon them, and those are the things that we're trying to address as we've been meeting and working through with the folks in the stakeholder group.
So if I'm understanding correctly, there is currently an active task force stakeholder group that is trying to work through this issue with the thought that there would be some legislation regarding guardianship coming up in the short session. Is that
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'd be interested to hear if there's any contrary view of this, but I mean, if that is the case, then certainly this subcommittee doesn't necessarily need to weigh in on that put anything in a bill that might be in conflict with other legislation that might be coming forward to address probably maybe some broader issues than what we're looking at here as far as the impact on governance per se. But I know that there was a concern that was expressed at the beginning of the subcommittee process that we take up and talk about guardianship, because I think the concern was several months ago I know there was concern in a number of quarters wanting guardianship to be talked about among a lot of people, you know, and understandably so, since it's in flux right now, and that's a major question out there that's got to be resolved, or well, a series of questions that have to be resolved. Are there any other questions or comments or observations on guardianship as it relates to what we're... Were you going to say something, Mr. Parker?
If there's a minute to go back to number 5, I'd like to have just 1 minute.
Okay. We'll hold that thought. Any other comments on guardianship at this point? I mean, if not, I think we'll leave that any action on that off of what we're doing it and leave it in the hands of what's going on with the stakeholders group, and let's see if we can get a handle on what's going on there. Mr. Parker.
Yes, and on the same page, the number 5 about the LGC, I know that we're going to be tasked to get more information on, but just to clarify, I guess, for this purpose, is that the LGC cannot assume control of an LME currently. That authority is in with the secretary. That's where they would make a decision. So I think the confusion in the statute is it uses the term governing body, and that's been interpreted to believe that's the LGC. The governing body in 159-28C or governing board is probably the area authority board. So what that statute does is doesn't allow the LGC to come in and override a decision of the LME, but it allows the LME to pay a bill that the finance officer of that LME refused, so long as the other provisions are there. So I just to clarify that the LGC would not come in and approve something that the finance officer of an area authority board disapproved, and that might clarify even the concern or the issue that was brought to the subcommittee.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, this is something that we just need to clarify in the statute is the governing board with the authority to be able to override the finance officer to pay a claim, for example.
Yes, and I don't know, again, even if I think they, when they use the term governing board, they're speaking to whatever local government board that is operating under that provision, not the local government commission.
Well, I think we can include whatever language we need to include to clarify that, set that straight. Okay. All right. We'll let you out of school early, but before we do, we have gone through a whole range of issues. What we will do is those items that there are a couple of items on here that we are going to need to get additional information to the subcommittee, I think, before people would be comfortable making any sort of recommendation on it one way or the other. And we will do that, and we will see if we can pull together some narrow language. I think Mr. Botts has volunteered to help on that in terms of the public records issue. We'll see if we can pull that together in a sufficient manner that would satisfy the committee. The other things that I think there were agreement on, we will incorporate into a revised draft legislation, and we'll get that sent out. And, of course, what we would hope to do is to resolve any final issues of what we might or might not include in that draft legislation in May, and then take a vote of the subcommittee as to whether you want to recommend that legislation to the Legislative Oversight Committee in May for consideration to be introduced to the General Assembly. Since we do have some additional time right now, what I would like to do is just open the floor up to members if there are other issues that we haven't gone through, or haven't been grinding through over the last few months that were burning on your mind that you thought, gee, I'm surprised this didn't come up or that didn't come up. I want to make sure that we go back through and pick up anything that someone on the committee might believe that we have left unaddressed. And I'll say that in the context of, obviously, I think there's a lot of folks that want to see a broader look at 122, and I think that will happen. Obviously, it can't happen between now and the short session. But given our mandate, were there any other comments of committee members or issues? Raymond, yes, sir.
One question. As some LMEs are just forming right now, some MCOs and appointing the boards, this legislation, if passed, will actually be enacted on July 1st, and that will mean that some people have to change board composition that they have done in the last 3 or 6 months to accommodate the change in the law.
Yes, sir. Other comment? Mr. Botts.
Your question, I'm not sure, I was a little confused by the question and answer, because this bill does say that notwithstanding Section 3, that members serving on the area boards on the effective date of this act may complete the terms for which they are appointed. So
okay.
I'm assuming then that would mean that the compositional requirements would be phased in.
There would be and I apologize for not adding that. There would be a time for transition, a time to,
provided to be able to transition to where we're going. Yeah, so you're right. It wouldn't be everybody's gone off the board effective at a date certain. That would not be the scenario. Ms. Weaver.
Well, since he brought that subject up, I'm wondering how the transition will work for those boards that might have county managers who are, according to the current statute, allowed to be on there as long as they're employed by their county. And if that hasn't changed, then how does this transition to the board that we're asking for work?
Mr. Parker.
Well, we can ensure to account for that, but I think the term, it's not the duration of the term will be the three-year term, not the multiple terms that a current county commissioner or county manager could serve. So I would believe that by allowing them to finish their term, it's wherever they are in that three-year period. But if that's not so, we can make sure it says
that. Well, currently it says that the county managers can serve for as long as they are employed.
We may need to put in some specific transition language there to make sure that that's clarified. We will do that. We will do that. Senator Hartzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not wishing to be perceived as a total cowboy, I should let the committee know in conjunction with some of the comments I made at the last meeting. I'm actually working on another structure more consistent with what is commonly known as the Hospital Authority Act. It's just a work in progress. And what I would propose, at some point, I'm not sure when or what, is to utilize this and submit it as an alternative, not necessarily in lieu of, but as a supplemental in case locals choose to do this as opposed to the other modifications to 122. But I'm just trying to do this based upon some prior experience I've had in setting up some others and just see what works out. Want to communicate, submit it to you, Mr. Chairman, do some other things, just as, like I say, as an alternative. It's not in lieu of. So.
And you're looking at that in separate legislation, that's if I understand you correctly.
Well, given the fact that the bill involving LME structure governance was my bill. It's actually on the House side now. Yeah, I guess that would probably be in there. Maybe. I'm not saying anything one way or another. I'm just trying to kind of... And the reason I'm suggesting this has as much to do with the fact that... it's not Holy Writ or anything at this point. But there are some LMEs that are a little farther along in the process and probably have a better feel for what would ultimately be a structure that might work and that their forming entities might find a little more suitable to their circumstance. That's what I'm not saying it is, not saying it's not. I'm not sure where it is. I'm just advising folks that.
Thank you. Ms. Coker.
Sorry. There have been a lot of email discussions since our last meeting about the inclusion of consumers on the boards. And the way this is all written, as it turns out, there's a potential of there only being one person who's actually a consumer, if I'm reading this the right way, and that being somebody that's on the Consumer Family Advisory Committee. And again, I think it's real important that when you're providing services to any group or anything, the more you have those folks involved in governance, the more likely you are to make really good decisions that will have the outcomes you want to have. And we've had years of all these decisions being made about people with disabilities with very uneven levels of participation, because the CFACs have been very uneven in how they do things and perform. And I just would wonder if there's any opportunity to discuss adding some more consumer membership to these boards.
I mean, to be candid, because I know Ms. Riddle had expressed at the last meeting or meeting before last or both the concept of having six people at some point in time. You know, now you could have a scenario where you have no one. So I think that what we're trying to arrive at is a balance between what we currently don't have, frankly, to an assurance that there will be representation there, balancing that with the fact that these are going to be managed care organizations, are really a totally different animal than what currently exists, needing some additional, the assurance of some additional expertise that we want to make sure is on there. So we've got that in there over a much broader area. So we're trying to keep the balance in terms of how large the actual committee itself is. One of the side effects of this that I hope comes out of it, that I think will come out of it, is I think that you will end up with, to the extent that some of the CFACs are not as strong as some of the advocates would like, I would think that those CFACs will become, this would be a process whereby they would actually become a little stronger because they would have the ability to have membership through the process on the actual governance board, which you currently do not have. So it's as this process has demonstrated, a challenge, a very difficult challenge, trying to make sure that you have appropriate consumer representation and balanced with the with all of the other interest. And certainly I think, in at least as drafted currently, you have greater representation than under the current system. Ms. Riddle.
Thank you, Representative Dollar. I respectfully would have to encourage the committee to at least consider having at least one family member or consumer from each of the disability groups. I've been in this field for now 22 years, and I've yet to see the developmental disabilities community be looked to as the appropriate advocate for the substance abuse or the mental health community. I think they are very, very, very different constituencies. I would personally prefer six, but short of that, I do believe that you would be looked upon more favorably by the family and consumer community were you to at least have one family or consumer representative from each of the three groups. Thank you, sir.
I think, Ms. Riddle, if you turn to page 3 under beginning on at the halfway down on line 18, I think that we have that. I think that we've got that protection in there that you had suggested, because I think you're right. The language on the preceding page in and of itself wouldn't cover. I mean, I think that's the correct interpretation that you were putting to that. And I think that we've got it covered in this follow-on provision where at least one member representing each of the following individuals with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and addiction. So, but take a look at that, you know, between now and the next meeting and see if that doesn't answer that part of it.
Thank you, sir. One very small drafting comment. There's enormous confusion in the field of developmental disabilities when you talk about intellectual disability, which is a subset of developmental disability, because there is so much confusion about it. As you, those of you who are draft, I would encourage you to write intellectual or other developmental disability. Thank you.
So instead of and, it'd be or other. We can do that. Okay. Other comments, observations? If, Mr. Simmons.
Will this be the final opportunity to comment on the changes, or will there be another opportunity?
Well, we're going to, yes, we're going to meet again. We're going to meet. Our next meeting will be back here on May the 14th. That'll be our final meeting when we'll actually take whatever formal action the committee determines to take. And like I say, we'll continue to take comments and observations, particularly as you look over the draft we have there, plus the additional information that the issues that we agreed upon today that we'll work into language and be getting out to you.
So would we comment at the next meeting, or can we submit comments between now and the next meeting?
Both. Both. But, yeah, if you got comments, the earlier the better. Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. If we have nothing further to come before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.